The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This week's podcast is sponsored by Ladbrokes Political Betting. Hello and welcome to Polling Politics, the election. I'm Joe Twyman from the public opinion consultancy Delta Poll.
And I'm freelance journalist Marie LeConte.
Every week during the campaign, Marie and I round up the key political stories and statistics of the week. And we're also joined by a top guest from the world of politics to delve into the polling and public opinion in more detail. Our guest today is Henry Zeffman. Hello, Henry.
Hello, Joe.
Henry is political correspondent for The Times. He's previously written for The Observer and The New Statesman and is a former winner of the Anthony Howard Award for Journalism, which he won when he was studying at Brasenose College, Oxford. PPE, I'm assuming?
Correct.
Gross.
Yeah.
That's great to hear.
When I was there, they were still proud of the David Cameron Association. a little bit less so now, I'm led to believe.
And as a journalist, presumably you've only been covering politics in a professional manner since all of this craziness.
That's basically true. I first started doing shifts during the Scottish referendum, which was the sort of the first salvo of, oh, this has gone a bit weird. And then I started at the Times doing the job I'm doing now 3 weeks before the EU referendum, spent the first couple of weeks on that red bus, which had £350 million a week for the NHS on the side of it. And it has been crazy ever since.
But isn't it really odd? Because I've got a similar experience. I started writing about politics full time in the summer of 2015. So I've never known quiet. And it's quite, and I don't know if you've had that, Henry, but talking to older political journalists who are like, so I remember talking to one actually who works for an American publication who was like, yeah, when I originally got the job, I had to convince my newsroom that they really needed one whole person to cover British politics full time. Because at the time they were like, you know, we don't need a whole person. We can have someone doing it on the side. Where now they've got an entire team. And then, yeah, even the idea of slow news weeks now feels completely alien.
Yeah, I mean, one of my colleagues likes to tell a story of at some point in the sort of Blair years when he had a stonking majority and was pretty popular, I think before Iraq, there was a sort of huge, all-consuming row for weeks over the fact that Patricia Hewitt, one of his cabinet ministers, had said that at times parts of Downing Street were a bit managerial, which now, I mean, would not pass for anything approaching.
That's not even a tweet.
Right, exactly.
Well, there's always the comparison from the United States about the huge kerfuffle around Barack Obama wearing a tan suit and the massive importance that was attached to that for a long period of time compared to one or two unusual things that have happened in the White House in more recent times. Yes, it's quite a period to be alive and quite a period to be an Anthony Howard Award-winning journalist. Main story this week, obviously Prince Andrew, but from a political point of view, main story this week, the debates.
Actually, before we get into that, can I just quickly say, I don't know if you saw the news that Prince Andrew is considering doing another TV interview, and I love that. I just love that so much.
He should do a full media round. Go around every single BBC local radio station.
Sit down, do a
LBC,
GNS.
Yeah. Phone in.
If at first you don't succeed, make things worse. That's the expression, isn't it? Certainly the unending belief in his own self-brilliance is...
It's almost as if a hereditary monarchy might do that to you.
You might think that, Henry, and I couldn't possibly comment except to say that I agree. But away from
Prince, I'm just not giving my opinion because I'm French, so I feel like, you know, it goes without saying.
Away from Prince Andrew, who, if we're all honest, is just a bit too honourable. the debates... Henry, it seems like a lot of effort for these debates. From your point of view as a journalist, does it make much difference?
They can do, but I thought last night's was really unilluminating, and I think the format wasn't great. It was a bad look for Boris Johnson to repeatedly talk over Julie Etchingham, the host, but I can see, at least at first, why he was frustrated that he seemed to only have sort of 40 seconds to answer questions like, should we trust you, or will you vow always to be polite, or whatever that handshake thing was about. But I do think it gave a sort of excuse to see, sort of, for the public who perhaps are only just tuning in now and then, perish the thought, to this general election campaign, it gave them a pretty clear sign of the contours of the campaign. So Boris Johnson brought every question back to Brexit, said, you know, Jeremy Corbyn was only talking about the NHS to distract from what I think he called the void at the heart of Jeremy Corbyn's Brexit policy. And Jeremy Corbyn, a bit iffy on Brexit, but as the debate moved on in the second portion to other issues, was much more at home and also thought on his feet a lot quicker than Boris Johnson, which I think some people would have been quite surprised by.
I do think the one issue actually with this specific sort of like election is that Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson, even to people who I think only follow politics a bit, are known quantities by this point. So that there's nothing I think you can properly learn. And you know, there's a reason why I think the biggest debate moment we've had in the UK so far was probably Cleggmania. Because, you know, because most people had not properly seen Nick Clegg before. And thinking about debates in other countries as well, in France, you know, Macron did really well in them, etc. So I do think that debates mostly work when at least one of the candidates is a bit of like, ooh, you know, are they going to exceed expectations? Are they going to, you know, completely flop? And in that case, you know, we know who Corbyn and Boris are. So I'm not sure how helpful that was, you know, ever going to be realistically.
Nick Clegg's the interesting case because there was a lot of hype around that at the time, but that was only after the first debate. There were a series of debates back in 2010, and I was running the polling for the snap polls immediately after that. And what's interesting about the first debate is that people did genuinely seem to answer in a non-partisan, fair and balanced way. And you also had a far wider range of people watching that first debate. Since then, what we've seen, and this was true of the polling last night as well, I think, is that generally speaking, people think that the party they support puts forward the leader that has the best debate. We saw 51-49 in the YouGov poll that was run immediately after things yesterday. It showed it was effectively a dead heat, which I think is representative of the fact that politics is probably a bit of a dead heat in that respect as well.
Although presumably Jeremy Corbyn's team will be pleased with the fact that, though the polls suggest that he is way behind Boris Johnson in terms of who people would rather see as Prime Minister in particular, and also party voting intention, he came much closer to a dead heat in the debate itself. But the question of whether that's just Tories saying, OK, well, yeah, he did a decent job, but obviously I'm not going to vote for him, or whether that's people genuinely considering switching because of last night.
Well, what I think it is when you've got the choice of the two, you'll just have people saying, oh, yeah, he probably did OK. And of course, expectations are lower for him, whereas for Boris Johnson, I think they're higher.
And I agree. And I was going to say, and this is a very clever point I'm entirely nicking from Twitter, but I'm not sure that back on the format of the debate, I'm not sure how helpful it actually is to have any sort of audience participation. And I think generally going forward, broadcasters should consider just not having any sort of audience. I don't really think that
helps.
Which
is something that was the case in those 2010 debates, in fact, where, or certainly the first one, where Nick Clegg...
There was an audience,
oh, yeah,
they weren't allowed to make any noise.
Yes, exactly. And,
well, this was, which is just weird in itself. This was going to be my next question. We have four of these events ahead of us. We have a total of four events. We've just had this first one. We've got a question time style debate with the four leaders. Then after that, we've got the seven-way cluster mess to look forward to. Your 3 seconds and everyone shouts over each other.
We had 11 in front, so cowards.
And then after that, on the 6th of December, we have a repeat of last night's format, much closer to the actual election date. I think that will be very different in the way that... in the way that they approach it. Whether it's different in the outcome, of course, remains to be seen. But a question to both of you. What do you think the ideal format is to get the most out of these debates?
I mean, it probably sounds ridiculously Panglossian, but I just think they should sit there and force them to interact to a silent audience, because, you know, you can try and get a representative audience all you like, but I think it is wrong that one audience member deciding to laugh at Corbyn or to jeer Johnson can dictate the sort of prism through which all those many millions of people at home think, oh yeah, that is funny. Well, no, they should be able to think for themselves. But also the lack of interaction between the two. And that's partly forced by the parties, who train their leaders to come back round to the soundbite and to deliver pithy things which can be clipped up. And I appreciate, so it is to an extent a sort of media political dynamic. But I do think if Julie Etchingham or whoever just asked a relatively open question and then forced them to discuss it in a pretty open-ended way for 20 minutes, we would find things more illuminating.
I'm quite annoyed because you've just nicked opinion.
And I was going to say that in France, exactly that.
They do that in France. Thank you very much. I actually think that's a really good format of, yeah, no, exactly, having, you know, maybe topics. And obviously definitely have someone, you know, telling people to shut up if needed. But I would really watch that. And I realised recently, actually, we never really see politicians from different parties having discussions on telly. Like, that's not really a thing that I think exists on British telly, which I would argue is a loss, because actually, you know, I think it can tell you quite a lot about people. And also, you know, you can't really, again, because I think the problem, and also the problem with having the audience there, is that it's always very tempting to resort back to the sound bites. Whereas I think if you're just having a conversation with someone, you can't exactly do that. You can't just have a sound bite off. But then the other point as well, so on a slightly different thing, and I'll turning back the question to you guys as well, but do we think the debate format has been cheapened a bit, especially like thinking back at the Tory leadership contest?
Do you mean just by putting it on ITV? I think that's a very elitist view.
I obviously have no television opinions. I've never had a television in my time in the UK, as we've discussed before. But no, I feel like the fact that, you know, we had the debates for the Tory leadership contest only a few months ago, like, it does kind of feel, I don't know, we've had a million of the Brexit ones as well. There's just always a kind of debate on, and it's not, because I remember 2010, where I was like, oh, a debate, you know, and we don't really have that anymore. So are they really going to be that influential when they're just really, they've kind of faded into the background a bit now?
I think they're here to stay, but will at the same time never actually produce much of interest unless someone manages to land a knockout blow or make an enormous gaffe, which I can't see happening. Henry?
Yeah, I mean, it's worth noting that last night's debate was an innovation. It was the first time we've had just the leader of the two biggest parties, just the two of them going head to head. Clearly, they are here to stay. I mean, Theresa May perhaps made the sort of biggest effort at the 2017 election to set a precedent that prime ministers don't necessarily end up doing them.
How did that work out for her?
Yeah, just about as well as her prime minister. Exactly. I mean, the seven-way debate, we should say that we're pretty sure that Boris Johnson isn't doing it. I think it's going to be Rishi Sunak, which is an extraordinary rise. I mean, he's not even a full member of the cabinet as chief secretary to the Treasury, and was one of the most junior, on the most junior rung of the ministerial ladder in early July, which is not that long ago. But he's a very capable media performer.
And unknown. So as Marie pointed out, that could be to
I think he might be the winner, the big winner of the debate season, maybe Rishi Sunak, I think.
Well, I suppose, yes, I think that's right. Clearly he's going to get a bigger job if Boris Johnson wins. But also, I suppose...
unless he does a really bad job.
Unless he does a really bad job, in which case he'll get sacked. But I think the days of the leader of the SNP or the Green Party or whoever getting to share a stage at the same time with the leader of the Conservative Party, perhaps the Prime Minister when that's a non-Tory leader at some point, I think that's probably over. I think 2015, where David Cameron did it once, would probably be the last time. I think that Theresa May and now Boris Johnson refusing to sort of diminish themselves, as they would see it, by going on stage with all of that lot, means that others won't.
We're joined now for our weekly chat with Matt Shattuck from Ladbrokes Politics. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Joe.
Every week we delve into a constituency, but before we get onto that, the debate, how does that play out in the betting markets? We were discussing it earlier. Does it make a difference to you guys?
Well, I mean, we did take quite a lot of money on it. We have our sort of buzzword bingo markets. You can bet on what people are going to say. That was pretty fun.
Did anyone go for get Brexit done?
Yes, that was 20-1 on. You could have made 5% quite easily doing that. We had Corbyn a slight favourite to win the debate, actually, and we were basing it on the YouGov poll, which just about gave it to Boris, which worked out in the bookies' favour, so that's not too bad. But in terms of moving the dial or the betting on the overall result of this election, it didn't make one jot of difference. The betting markets responded as if it hadn't happened, and that probably was the wise thing to do, I guess.
So, this week's constituency, Ashfield in Nottinghamshire, currently held by Gloria De Piero, but she's leaving. What's the situation there?
Yeah, totally fascinating. We've taken more bets on this seat than any other in the country. And right now, the narrow favourite is a character called Jason Zadrozny, who's the leader of the Ashfield Independents, who swept the board and the local councils there this year. He actually ran as the Liberal Democrat candidate for this seat in 2010. Not a very promising area, generally, for the Lib Dems around here, the East Midlands. But he got within 200 votes of winning the seat then. He's since switched to the Independents. And yeah, we think he's got a great chance of winning this. It's more or less a four-way contest because it's also quite plausible that, of course, Labour could hold on, the Tories could take the seat, and even the Brexit Party are throwing a few resources at this place.
In 2017, Gloria De Piero won with only 441 as a majority, so it's really, really close. And the Ashfield Independents did get 9% of the vote last time round, so there's clearly something going on there, which is extremely
interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think that made them the second highest scoring independents that particular election. 10% is pretty good, right, for an independent. Now they've got the council leader there.
And the Brexit Party could be a factor this time round. UKIP only got 4%. 5% last time, but they've put up Martin Daubney, one of their MEPs.
I just had to at the mention of Martin Daubney, who I believe is a men's rights activist. But no, as a quick point, what I really like about Ashfield is the fact that this race is obviously being run between an independent who one of Jason's member of staff, I think, used to work for Gloria De Piero, but also the Conservative candidate used to work for Gloria De Piero as well. So it's kind of that entire office being like, we all hate each other, we'll stand against each other and help other parties win.
Yeah, I mean, totally fascinating character. I think he was leader of the council at 26. So in some ways, I'd quite like him to win because it'd just be an interesting person in Parliament rather than another, you know, Tory or Labour candidate. So yeah, I don't know if anyone will poll this seat, Joe, but looks fascinating.
I'm not sure if there's been any polling, not as far as I know, but it will be an interesting one to see. And it's fascinating that it's attracted so much attention. In terms of the overall picture, how has that changed in the last week?
Pretty steady, a slight move continuing in favour of a Tory majority. So if we put it in percentage terms, the betting markets right now are saying there's about a 65% chance of a Tory majority, something like a 32% chance of a hung parliament, and 2 or 3% chance of a Labour majority.
Matthew, thank you. We'll speak to you next week. Moving on then. Henry, how's your election going?
I'm enjoying it, but it is quite formulaic. I mean, the reality of elections is that every day, in a way that you don't have generally in politics and particularly haven't had in the chaos of the last couple of years. But every day, the Tories do an event, Labour do an event, Lib Dems do an event. They all announce a policy into tomorrow and you kind of just settle into a natural rhythm. 2017 was like that until the manifestos, at which point, well, I remember vividly being in the hall in Wrexham when Theresa May said, nothing has changed, and turning to people sat either side of me and going, that was a bit weird, wasn't it? But short of something like that happening again, I think we probably are basically settled into quite a set formula with quite rigid battle lines for the rest of the campaign.
It just kind of, yeah, does it not feel like no one's heart is properly into it? Like, kind of feels
like
we're
in terms of the public or in terms of the politicians as well?
I don't know. I'm kind of thinking the bubble a bit, I guess, here. But in a way, I kind of feel like, you know, everyone's kind of going through the motions, but kind of for the sake of it. And, you know, and yeah, again, like the battle lines have been drawn and, you know, the Tories are trotting out into Labour lines and vice versa. But no one feels really, I don't know. I feel like, you know, and we were talking about it before starting recording, but there's not really been a moment yet of the election. And obviously, it's still quite early days. You know, it will almost certainly come, but it doesn't feel like there's been anything that's been defining or anything that's changed, you know, kind of, you know, if not the entire outcome, but, you know, something at least. There's no current point out. There's nothing I can point to now if you were to ask me, okay, in 10 years, you know, what will this election be remembered as? The way that 2017 was maybe the dementia tax election or the nothing has changed election or the, you know, whichever. Like, there's not really been a moment yet.
My sense is that the general public probably aren't paying that much attention to things. And for them, the general election doesn't really begin until the manifestos are launched. And
how normal is it? I mean, my sense, but you'll know much better than me, Joe, is that it's incredibly rare for public opinion to move dramatically over the course of an election campaign in the way that it did in 2017.
Oh, we discussed it in the previous episode of Polling Politics, Henry.
You must have missed that particular episode that when you were listening and catching up.
Cut that out. Sorry, Nick.
Historically, campaigns haven't made that much of a difference, and the position at the start of the campaign in the terms of the polls has been pretty similar to the position at the end. And that's why people wrongly believe that polls by definition have predictive power, because in the past they have happened to have that. But in 2017 we saw how things could change. The question is that the new normal? Is 2017 the way that things will go now, or was that just a blip? So far it appears that things are just a blip, but we haven't had the manifestos yet. There's still plenty of time for things to go wrong.
I mean, it's clearly possible for the polls to end up basically where they were at the start of the campaign, at the end of the campaign, for Boris Johnson to win perhaps a narrow majority, and for it still to be true that this was one of the most volatile elections ever, in the sense that there still would have been this extraordinary reshuffling of political allegiances since the last election and since before then. So I suppose perhaps the volatility just happened in the run-up to the election rather than during the campaign itself.
Well, there's the statistic from the British Election Survey that suggests that nearly half of people voting in this election will have voted for a different party at some point between now and 2010. That's an enormous number of people churning from one
musical
party
chairs
to a party to the other. Yeah, exactly. Musical chairs, just less fun. And so, yes, you're right, we do have that volatility. But whether that volatility then plays out in an election campaign or not, as I say, remains to be seen because it is too early.
Mm. But isn't it the case as well that whatever people are predicting at the moment on, you know, what will happen on December the 12th, everyone seems quite certain that quite a lot of seats will change hands. So it'll probably end up, you know, being the overall numbers on the green benches at the end of it will probably not be sort of wildly dissimilar to what we have at the moment or what we had in the last parliament. But seats, because again, because electoral coalitions are changing, are shifting. So we may just end up having, again, similar sort of like figures for different parties, but from different bits of the country or different sort of, you know.
Well, that's the assumption, but we just don't know. Mm. Okay, Henry, it's now time for your big five election questions. Are you excited? I can tell you're excited. Firstly, what will you be doing during the campaign?
Going out around the country, hopefully, particularly in the last couple of weeks, party leaders start to take journalists on their buses.
So are you following on the buses or are you doing independent reporting in other areas?
A bit of both. So in the last election campaign, particularly in the last week of the campaign, I basically followed Theresa May around to all these places, which afterwards I thought no Tory leader is ever going to Darlington again. And hey, guess where Boris Johnson is today? Because it turns out the Tories decided the problem wasn't the unique electoral strategy of Theresa May, it was Theresa May. But also trying to do a bit of independent reporting, you know, if you happen to end up in an interesting seat via the Prime Minister. But, you know, there are well-rehearsed limitations to standing in a high street in the middle of the day when the vast majority of people in that seat are at work and thinking that the people you speak to there might tell you lots. I mean, they can definitely tell you something and you know, with appropriate scepticism, then it's very interesting. But yeah, you need to sort of be clear about who you're speaking to.
Question two, what will you be doing during the election day?
I will probably be off work.
That's the spirit.
So, well, the reality of sort of print deadlines are such that as the exit poll drops, we will crash out for Friday the 13th, a very quick splash about what that indicates. But there's not time to do loads and not enough information to do loads, of course, at that point for first edition. But equally, there's not a lot you can do during the day because campaigning sort of stops and people don't want to read over their cornflakes on Friday when they know the result, a load of stuff that you prepared earlier. So it's a sort of quiet day / day off until 10 p.m, at which point I'll be working through the night.
Which leads me on to the next question. What will you be doing during the election night?
Working through the night. So we'll keep publishing fresher and fresher editions of the Times in print until
How many editions do you publish?
It varies. I mean, usually two or three on a normal day, but for the election it'll probably be four. But online, of course, we'll be going through the night and updating through the night. At some point, I might get a bit of sleep, although the last two major electoral events I've covered for the Times, so 2016 referendum and the 2017 election, both times I've been on the sort of exit poll shift, or not an exit poll in 2016, with the idea that in the sort of 4 a.m.-ish or something, I would go home and then come back at sort of
once
10 or so.
Once things are quietened down.
But on both occasions, in 2016, I just ended up going to Downing Street and watching Cameron resign because that was fascinating. And in 2017, I just went straight through because the result was so shocking.
Okay, that reminds me of one of the bleakest moments, I think, of my entire life, which is...
Excellent. Let's all sit down and listen to this.
It was just Trump night. So my friend owns this bar in Hackney and was like, oh, I own a bar, I can just have an election night and like close it and have my friends there. Did that, and at first he had this massive screen showing InfoWars, which he thought would be very funny. Obviously it got, you know, sort of like less and less funny throughout the night. And my thing was that
to the point where it was really, really not funny.
Yeah, we really had to change the channel. But no, but basically, because I was working the next day anyway, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to stay in the bar until about 2-3 a.m. By then we should know that Hillary's got it, and then I can go to bed and have like 4 hours of sleep and it'll be fine. Obviously that didn't happen, so I ended up drinking cocktails until about 5-6 a.m. took a cab back to my house, slept for 45 minutes and then got in a cab back to work. I was working at BuzzFeed at the time, and then cried in the cab and then got to work. And generally, I think that's one of the lowest points.
God, that is a miserable, miserable story. Putting the buzz in BuzzFeed. Question five comes after question four, which is, what do you think will happen?
I'm very loath to make predictions, but since you ask, at the moment, if push came to shove, I think a narrow Tory majority, by which I mean sort of 5-15 seat majority.
So I agree. However, I've realised that I now know what the best banter result would be. it would be
optimum
for,
banter.
Yes, yeah, so optimum banter would be for the Conservatives to win precisely one extra seat. So all of this for one seat.
And lastly, question five, Henry. Who do you think will be the next Prime Minister?
So if we go with my narrow Tory majority prediction for the sake of consistency, therefore I think the next Prime Minister will be a Tory Prime Minister. I'd imagine they would end up tearing themselves to shreds over something, probably Europe, at some point during that five-year term. So I'm going to say Rishi Sunak.
You heard it here first, guys. And finally then, Marie and Henry, what proportion of the British public do you think believe the upcoming general election will be conducted fairly?
Oh, wow. Is that going to be a bummer? I'm going to be optimistic, maybe say 90% of people feel it'll be conducted fairly.
Okay, I'm not going to be anywhere near that optimistic. Do they mean like fairly by the participants, right? Rather than what percentage of the British public believe that it's being manipulated by Russia or whatever?
Well, the full question was, in some countries, most people believe their elections are conducted fairly.
Oh, I see.
In other countries, many people believe their elections are conducted unfairly.
Okay.
How fair, if at all, would you say each of the following are? And then the option was the upcoming general election on 12th of
December. Okay, well, in that case, maybe 60%?
You know what? He's absolutely right. 60%. I mean, we always knew Henry was smart, even when he turned up in a top hat. But he's demonstrated today. 60%. 22% say very fair. 38% say quite fair. And then at the other end of the scale, you have 27% saying not fair, either not very fair or not at all fair. Among Labour, it's 36% say not fair. Among the Lib Dems, 35% not fair. And the Brexit Party, 32% not fair. So around a third of Labour, Lib Dem and Brexit Party supporters don't think the election will be conducted fairly. So that's a nice thought that we can all go
what
into
a nice
the last
yeah,
exactly. last 3 weeks of the campaign we can all think about that. That's a nice thought. Henry, thank you very much for coming in and well done for getting that completely right. You win an invitation to the polling podcast Christmas party.
What's polling podcast?
What is polling podcast? And also, are we having a Christmas party?
You are now.
Henry, thanks very much for coming in. Thanks also to Matt from Ladbrokes and from Ladbrokes Politics for sponsoring this. We will see you next week. Please remember to like, subscribe, review, all these different things that help people hear about us, and do tell all of your friends and many of the people that you don't know, even if you haven't enjoyed the podcast. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton, and our theme tune is by Joe Button.
For more details, go to podopods.com, and for sales and advertising, email nick@podopods.com.
And yes, that's spelled podopods.com.